September, thousands of children sort of catch up classes. And these are, you know, children, youth. I met 14, 15 year old people who have never been to school because they've been fleeing all their life.
We have 20 seconds.
And they are able to go back to school now because we got some funding from the US and from Europe. If we got more funding, we could give to many more. There is hope.
Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to us from Oslo, Norway, just back from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Ocherina Nadura, Sam Markoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a six-month study finds drugs, including fentanyl in small amounts, on public transportation in Portland and Seattle. People pack into a community meeting looking for the latest information about the Camp Creek wildfire. And local food banks are coming up short on volunteers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 7th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. The University of Washington today released the results of a six-month study into drugs on public transit in Portland and Seattle. The team put monitors on buses and trains, including TriMet, and found extremely small amounts of fentanyl, cocaine, and other drugs. Experts say the amounts of the drugs are too small to produce physical effects from short-term exposure that riders would have. TriMet's Roberta Alstad and Dr. Robert Hendrickson, medical director of the Oregon Poison Control Center and an OHSU professor, discussed the findings this morning. Here's part of what they said.
We're talking micrograms and nanograms. And if you're like me, you probably haven't really heard a lot about micrograms and nanograms before the study findings came out. So I did a lot of research on this and spoke quite a bit to the health experts to wrap my head around this. So a microgram is a millionth of a gram, or 1,000th of a milligram. A nanogram is 1 billionth of a gram, a millionth of a milligram, and 1,000th of a microgram. So again, very small levels here, concentration. I still was wondering, so what does that mean? So taking it down a little bit further, I asked and did some research about, you know, how can I comprehend this? So a grain of sand weighs approximately 23 milligrams. Now there are different sizes of, you know, little sand particles, but generally, I think that might help people's understanding that, you know, you're talking, you know, less than a microgram is, you know, very much smaller than a grain of sand. The same with a fine sugar crystal that you get in those little packets that you see at the restaurants. Those, one single sugar crystal is approximately 20 milligrams. Again, that's 20 million times larger than a nanogram. That sugar crystal is 20 million times larger than a nanogram, 20,000 times larger than a microgram. Again, just trying to put some context to these findings. So taking a look now at the findings. So these were the samples, the air samples that were conducted by University of Washington researchers on TriMet MAX trains. They tested on 10 two-car MAX trains, as well as a single LRV, light rail vehicle. They took 16 total samples, and they had three of those positive for fentanyl on the passenger side of the operator cab door, and this was a paired sample, so three on the inside of the cab door. Their pumps were placed on the ceiling right inside the cab door and right outside of it and connected with tubing, so that the air flowed from the passenger area in through one pump and into the operator cab. So six of the 16 air samples showed positive for fentanyl. Again, we're talking very low levels here. These are all way below a microgram. All the air samples did test positive for methamphetamine, but again, very small levels. They tested seven samples for cocaine in the air. One of those samples did test positive for cocaine. On the surface samples mainly were done on the passenger side of the cab door where the operator sits, mid-train on either a divider or seat, mid-train, and then at the rear of the train. The trains that they were testing on were what we call a type fours and fives that have bench seating at the back. They don't have a second cab at the back. They just have bench seating. So they took a sample back there near that seating.
My name is Dr. Rob Hendrickson. I'm the medical director of the Poison Center, and I'm a physician who's board certified in medical toxicology, which is the clinical study of the effects of substances on humans like drugs, methamphetamine, and fentanyl. I was asked to come to comment mostly on the risk of exposure to fentanyl and methamphetamine based on these study findings, but I am happy to answer any questions that I can. I hope to be a bit of a community resource and sort of help people understand the findings of the study. So in regards to the study itself, the presence of or detecting methamphetamine and fentanyl initially in a public place initially sounds alarming. But I was not surprised by the results, because anytime someone is handling or using a drug, we're going to be able to detect small amounts of that chemical in the air or on surfaces where they were or where they were using or where they were handling it with modern laboratory methods. And in fact, you know, we've known in many cases, we've known that you can detect cocaine on dollar bills and other paper money, and we've known that for decades now. So it's not surprising to find a small amount. I think the key with this study from a safety standpoint is that the amount of the drugs were extremely small. And we have a wealth of experience of dosing of both of these drugs, because they're both prescription drugs, or were at one time. And based on this study, the exposures to the quantity of drugs that are demonstrated do not pose a risk of drug toxicity. And in fact, most cases, the amount of the drug was hundreds to thousands of times smaller than would cause clinical effects. So while fentanyl and methamphetamine were detected on TriMet stations, TriMet trains, I apologize, the quantity of the drugs found are really, really small, and too small to be a risk for riders and employees. That doesn't take away, as I said, from the idea that they are detected, but the concentration is just extremely, extremely small. And I can give a bit of an example, because I think you did a good job of demonstrating how small these quantities are, but there's the largest amount of fentanyl on one of these wipe samples was about 0.7 nanograms per centimeter squared. And most people are not used to dealing with nanograms per centimeter squared. So let me try to put that in perspective a little bit. A centimeter squared is about the size of your fingerprint. So how much fentanyl, if you went to the most contaminated area of a train in this study and touched the wall, how much fentanyl would be on your fingertip? And the answer is a bit lower than a nanogram. And when you think back to that analogy of you take your little sugar packet that's about 2 to 4 grams, and you take a single crystal of white granulated sugar, and the amount that would be on your fingertip would be 1/20 millionth of that single crystal. So we're talking about extremely, extremely small amounts of both methamphetamine and fentanyl that were demonstrated in the study.
That was Dr. Robert Hendrickson, the medical director of the Oregon Poison Control Center. More than 500 people are fighting the Camp Creek fire burning near Portland's water source. The fire spread to 1,940 acres and is 16% contained. Last night, firefighters held a community meeting with neighbors and Welches who gathered at the Mount Hood Lions Club.
I'm Daniel Neibauer, Clackamas County Disaster Management, and we've been working very close with the incident management team and watching all the efforts they've been putting into, and have every confidence that they're going to stop the fire as they're planning to do. But my job's to be, if that doesn't happen, and what planning are we doing for that? So last time I was here, we talked about one evacuation zone and some management action point that we had planned for that. Since then, we've established another one to the west, and we've done some other kind of tentative contingency ones depending if this fire goes. So we have evacuation zones and decision points all planned out to be able to look for that and have that evacuation planning going. Also, and I think we're a little unclear last time we were here, alerting wise, we are working on alerting. We have multiple alerting methods to use, from the EAS system that was mentioned last time. That is an option, not one that we use commonly, but it is an option. We have the public alerts option. If you haven't signed up for public alerts, please do. There's postcards in the back that can facilitate you do that. And there's a wireless emergency alert system that we have. We use all of those to notify you as alerts. We also have Facebook relationships with media, social media, other ways to alert you. So we have multiple ways to do alerting. So we have alerting templates figured out, messaging completed if it does occur there. So we will get that message out to you quickly. Shelter planning. We have shelter planning for community members as well as livestock planned out. We've got the staffing plans for all those complete. For anyone who has additional needs, we have a location for those individuals. We have equipment pre-staged, purchased, all ready to go to open those up. Agreements and relationships in place with all of those locations. We also have established an evacuation resource center. So if we do evacuations, a nearby center that you can go to pick up information or other resources that you may need if evacuations are occurring. So we've been doing all that. We've been working with messaging. We're here tonight. We are at those information pop-ups. If you have any questions later on, where county and disaster management staff can be there to help answer those. So just a little update. We've been continuing working since we've seen you. I do want to take a little bit of time to introduce the Mount Hood Corridor Wildfire Partnership. And the goal is to do wildfire mitigation and reduce wildfire risk within the Mount Hood Corridor. And I know there are some folks here today that are members or agencies that are participating. If you are, can you raise your hand or just stand up? So if you take a look around, there are a lot of people in this room that are participating in that.
I'm Maida Lofsgarden. I'm forest supervisor here on the Mount Hood. I'm the best forest in the region and glad to come and talk to you a little bit about what's going on with the fire. First thing I want to do is give a huge shout out again to this incident management team. We are incredibly lucky to have the folks that we have here, the expertise that we have. I think you've seen it in the presentations from Isaac. Again, I agree his flight skills maybe not so much, but his operation skills are outstanding. So we are very lucky and very privileged to have this group with us and helping us on this fire. The weather is helping, but these folks are just doing a phenomenal job. I want to spend a minute and talk about, we've heard about line prep and what's going on there. I'm going to take you on a little bit of a story of what I'm seeing up there as forest supervisor and not as a firefighter, and just talk to you about what we're seeing and then talk about what you're going to be seeing down here on the 26 corridor in the near future. So I've had an opportunity over the last few days to take a couple of trips out there and spend some time looking specifically at those areas that we're talking about. And these guys do a great job of talking about, you know, we're doing line prep. We're taking out some trees. It's steep ground. We're working in steep areas. We're concerned about firefighter safety. I want to give just an example over here on this hand line. So your own Zigzag Hotshot crew was working up there on that hand line. And I had a chance to take firefighter training this summer, and I got to dig a hand line, and it was on a piece about as flat as this. Best workout that I got. I went out and stood up on the road above where they were working. They were about 50 feet down the line from me. And at 50 feet down the line, I could have just about dropped a candy bar down for them to catch. So 50 feet down the line, just about straight down the hill. So when they're talking about steep, the flight really helps. But when you're out there looking at it, these guys are operating in some incredibly steep territory. There's a lot of things they have to pay attention to in terms of firefighter safety.
And that was part of a community meeting last night about the Camp Creek wildfire. A Republican U.S. senator is delaying military promotions and nominations due to his views on abortion access. KBOO's Josh Salem has an in-depth look at this story.
A Republican senator from Alabama is holding up hundreds of military nominations and promotions related to travel policy concerning abortions. The secretaries of the Navy, Air Force, and Army wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post this week saying the efforts are unfair to the military and that they put our national security at risk. Senate approval for military promotions has long been routine, but Senator Tommy Tuberville has been blocking the nominations to pressure the Defense Department into rescinding a policy that reimburses service members who have to travel out of state for abortions and other reproductive care. His action leaves key positions unfilled and has raised concerns at the Pentagon about military readiness. As one example of repercussions seen, the U.S. Marines are without a confirmed leader for the first time in 100 years. Secretary of the Navy Carlos Del Toro said Tuberville is, quote, playing Russian roulette with the very lives of our service members by denying them the opportunity to actually have the most experienced combat leaders in those positions to lead them in times of peace and in times of combat, end quote. The secretaries are also concerned that future military leaders might think their service is no longer valued by Congress and, by extension, the American people. Tuberville responded that the three defense secretaries should have spoken with him first. There have been multiple attempts by both the department's top civilian leaders and its top uniformed personnel to demonstrate to Tuberville how the holds are doing harm, according to a senior military official. Tuberville still did not seem willing to change his position. He said he would lift his hold on the military nominations only after the Pentagon rescinds the policy that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin put into place last October, after the Supreme Court ended the constitutional protections for abortion. Democratic leaders would have to hold roll call votes on every nomination and promotion to get around the block, a time-consuming process. It's been a decades-long tradition for the Senate to group military nominations and approve them by voice vote, reserving valuable floor time for other important issues. Lawmakers from both parties have threatened holds on military promotions over the years, according to Tuberville's office. What's unprecedented now is the length of time the block has gone on. The Pentagon has not provided data on the number of service members who have relied on the new policy to get access to an abortion. It says the new policy was in response to the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, which created a situation wherein federal troops serving in one state may not have access to the same type of reproductive services available in others. Some Republicans have suggested that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat New York, could hold votes on some of the most critical nominations, but Schumer has rejected that approach. He said, quote, the bottom line is, this is a problem created by Republicans, and it's up to them to solve it, end quote. Tuberville brushed aside criticisms, vowing he will not give in. He added, quote, we're going to be in a holding period for a long time, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Food banks in Oregon and Washington are reporting a shortage of volunteers since the height of the pandemic. As Eric Tegadoff reports, they say it's hurting their ability to serve communities just as the need for food assistance has increased.
Head of the University District Food Bank in Seattle, Joe Gruber, says they have about 300 weekly volunteers that make their operations possible. But with COVID-19 worries subsiding this summer, their usual volunteer base has been getting out and traveling more than past years. Gruber says the shortage comes at an unfortunate time because they're busier than at any point during the pandemic, seeing 50% more people in 2023 than 2022. He says the increased need stems from a confluence of issues.
The inflation that folks have experienced over the last few years. And then we've also seen an erosion of some of the enhanced benefits, like SNAP had received some extra dollars.
An increase in funds for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, during the pandemic ended in March. A recent study found SNAP recipients experienced a 21% increase in food insufficiency after the increase ended. Gruber says the lack of volunteers is hurting not just inside the food bank, but in other operations, such as their home delivery program. He says they've also seen a 10 to 15% decline in food donations, which means they have to buy more food.
We're needing to fundraise more money to make sure that we've got those resources available. And that's another way that volunteers have helped us in the past, right? We have an annual fundraising auction where we'll hope to raise $250,000 or $300,000. And it happens because volunteers commit.
Gruber says fortunately for his food bank, students at the nearby University of Washington campus lend their assistance.
They've engaged deeply in our work and supported it. And so hopefully for us, we'll have a resource that not every food bank will have available to them, an abundant pool of interested and engaged students starting back in the fall.
This is Eric Tegadoff for Oregon News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this news for KBOO News In Depth. First, it's the Global Citizen International Digest with Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. Then, an interview with the President and CEO of the Urban League of Portland, Nkengay Harmon Johnson. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, mostly clear, down to 53. Tomorrow's weather, lots of sunshine, a high of 79. Today in history, on this date in 1977, a treaty was signed between the U.S. and Panama, giving control of the canal that connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans to Panama. The canal had been under U.S. control since it was built in 1904. Our quote of the day is from Teddy Roosevelt. A finer body of men has never been gathered by any nation than the men who have done the work of building the Panama Canal. A lawsuit aims to remove Donald Trump from the Colorado ballot. Alabama abortion advocates fight for out-of-state abortion rights, and organizers seek a commission to study reparations. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's 2023 Talks.
We are prepared to put on evidence and witnesses to prove that Donald Trump engaged in the January 6th insurrection, and hopefully that leads to accountability.
Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington is suing to remove former President Donald Trump from Colorado's primary presidential ballot. Donald Sherman, Crew's chief counsel, says their lawsuit aims to disqualify Trump on the grounds that he violated the 14th Amendment. That post-Civil War language says anyone who took an oath to uphold the Constitution but then engages in rebellion should be disqualified. Crew successfully used this argument to force a New Mexico County commissioner from office. Sherman says based on that, other elected officials who took part in the January 6th insurrection could also be disqualified.
There are numerous other people, lower profile people, that certainly deserve to be disqualified from office as well. But as in everything, Donald Trump sort of takes all the oxygen out of the room.
A brief written in August by two members of the Conservative Federalist Society argued courts should consider disqualifying Trump on those grounds. Meanwhile, a lawsuit has been filed against the Alabama Attorney General's office for what plaintiffs call threats to criminalize people seeking out-of-state abortions. Janice Fountain with the Yellowhammer Fund feels Alabama AG Steve Marshall could threaten the organization with prosecution for advocating for something that's fully legal and clearly beyond the Attorney General's right to regulate.
It's important to take a stand because not everyone is able to vocalize their disdain or organize around it, and we are. And so I think it's important for folks to know, like, there are people out here advocating for us having autonomy over our bodies, and it's not something that we can just, like, lay down and say, oh, this is fine.
Missouri Democratic Representative Cori Bush has introduced a $14 trillion measure to compensate the descendants of slaves. While that looks like a long shot, backers want President Joe Biden to support studying the issue through a commission to look at reparations, including but not limited to financial compensation. Maurice Mitchell with the Working Families Party says reparations offer a public safety solution.
Because it is establishing what America has to be in order to be a just and democratic country. And it's also establishing the truth of the American story and connecting American history to American present.
Facing questions from reporters about the state of his health, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell again said he'll finish out his term in the Senate and continue as Minority Leader. The junior senator from Kentucky, Republican Rand Paul, has cast doubt on the opinion of the Senate doctor that McConnell was suffering from dehydration. Paul told Axios that the physician who cleared the leader of his caucus to return to work had not given a valid medical diagnosis. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Environmental justice advocates say they want to empower marginalized communities so they can better respond to climate change threats. Mike Moen looks at one effort involving hurricane recovery efforts in Puerto Rico.
Next week, elected officials in Minnesota, along with Latine and environmental organizations, will gather to discuss a recent delegation trip to Puerto Rico. Participants say climate solutions they observed underscore the strength of grassroots work. The week-long visit in the first half of August was led by communities organizing Latine Power in Action, or COPAL. Those who made the trip saw firsthand how certain areas are establishing climate resiliency in the wake of two large hurricanes that devastated the island in 2017. State Representative Maria Isa Perez Vega, who has Puerto Rican roots, was part of the delegation and says community-driven efforts really stood out.
We have resources here in the states that they don't. They've managed to live without power, without water, without hospitals, and schools being shut down.
The delegation points to a mountain town developing a community-owned solar microgrid that stands a better chance of keeping the power on in a disaster. Officials hope such work inspires Minnesota community organizers to balance their grassroots responses to climate threats with calls for more equitable policies. Next Tuesday's discussion from 6 to 8 p.m. will be held at the COPAL Workers Center in South Minneapolis. Ryan Perez is organizing director for COPAL. He says the trip also revealed more issues that stem from climate migration.
We were really fortunate enough to visit a migration organization in Puerto Rico, and that organization actually addresses Dominicans and Haitians that migrate to the island because the conditions there are better than in Dominican Republic and Haiti.
Perez notes that within Puerto Rico, there are some levels of discrimination towards those individuals migrating to the island. He suggests that while the Midwest faces its own climate threats, the Minnesota region could learn lessons about welcoming others who travel here to escape weather disasters from other parts of the world. This is Mike Moen.
The U.S. Interior Department cancels remaining Arctic oil leases originally signed under former President Trump. Guatemala's Attorney General is taking a look at a presidential election and a new marker as part of an Indigenous Place Names project. With these stories and more, here's today's edition of National Native News.
The Interior Department will cancel its remaining oil leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This will prevent drilling in 13 acres in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The Biden administration declared that the ANWR lease sale, which was held in 2021 during the final days of the Trump's administration, violated federal law. The Interior Department also added protections by putting a stop to offshore drilling in the federal waters of the Beaufort Sea earlier this year, almost a year before the administration approved ConocoPhillips' $8 billion oil development project, Willow, in the reserve. Guatemala's much-criticized attorney general met with the head of the Organization of American States this week about her Justice Department's role in the country's turbulent election process. Meanwhile, indigenous leaders carried out traditional ceremonies to censure the attorney general and others they accuse of corruption. Maria Martin reports.
After her meeting with OAS Secretary General Luis Almagro, Guatemala's Attorney General Consuelo Porras says there's a campaign to discredit her and her Justice Department for investigating valid legal complaints. She rejected the accusation that her investigation of President-elect Bernardo Arevalo's Semilla Party is an attempt at a legal coup. The Justice Department's only defending democracy and the legal order, says Porras. Meanwhile, indigenous groups are stepping up actions calling for her resignation. On Tuesday, Maya ancestral authorities performed a traditional ceremony outside the presidential palace, asking for punishment for corrupt government officials. For National Native News, I'm Maria Martin.
There's a new marker along Anchorage's coastal trail. It says Nuch Ishtunt, which means the place protected from the wind in Dena'ina Athabascan. The sign is part of the Indigenous Place Names Project and as a reminder that Dena'ina people were and continue to be part of Anchorage. Jeremy Shea reports from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage.
At a ceremony celebrating the new signpost, Aaron Leggett shares an anecdote about meeting other young Alaska Natives when he was 19, working at the Alaska Native Heritage Center.
And I told them that I was Dena'ina, and they said, well, what's that? And then they said, where's your village? Well, Aklutna is 26 miles from downtown Anchorage. And some of them who had grown up in Anchorage said, well, I didn't know Native people lived here.
He says he realized Dena'ina were largely invisible, and he wanted to work on reclaiming who Dena'ina are as a people. That was more than 20 years ago. Now, Leggett is the president of the Native Village of Aklutna and a curator with the Anchorage Museum. He's been working on the Indigenous Place Names Project since its inception in 2018. The Nuch Ishtunt sign is the effort's fourth installment. Dena'ina people used to set up seasonal salmon fishing camps near this point, up until federal officials banned commercial fishing here in the 1950s.
Indigenous placemaking deepens the connection we have to place.
Beth Nordland is the executive director of the Anchorage Park Foundation, another organization working on the project.
This is bigger than signs. It's a movement.
Project supporters eventually want to put up 32 of these sculpture signs in high visibility areas around Anchorage and Aklutna. They each feature iron artwork representing a fire bag, which is a pouch used to carry materials for starting a fire. It's also a symbol of living outdoors and sharing. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
I'm Jill Freitas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 7th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips, 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegedoff, Mike Moen, and Mark Moran. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, coming up next. First, it's the Global Citizen International Digest with Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov, and then an interview with the President and CEO of the Urban League of Portland, Nkengay Harmon Johnson.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Bargaining with the devil in the Middle East. The United States and Israel are desperate to bring about a normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Naturally, each of the three parties has conditions, each has a certain amount of leverage, and each has options in case the goal can't be met. And it just might be that a deal contains ingredients that should make it untouchable. To normalize relations with Israel, Saudi Arabia is demanding access to uranium enrichment technology and a U.S. security guarantee, presumably against a threat from Iran, despite their having only recently concluded a normalization agreement. Israel wants to normalize relations with the Saudis as a means of gaining legitimacy and driving a wedge between